You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 7th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hello, Governor. How are you?
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi.
In 1610, on this day.
Hello, Governor. How are you, Evan?
Our good friend, Galileo. I'm just fine, Jay.
Now you guys are just fishing for angry emails. You are literally trying to get as much angry feedback as possible. That's great.
Fishing, we're using one of those huge nets.
Yeah, casting a wide net.
Okay. So anyone want to guess what Galileo observed on this day?
Oh, was it global warming?
The moons of Jupiter.
Yes, Bob.
The four largest moons of Jupiter? You mean the Galilean satellites?
Exactly correct. On this very day in 1610.
Can you imagine that?
I can only imagine that.
That must have been one of the high points of his life right there.
And 400 years ago. Can you imagine that?
And that broke a lot of dogma. I mean, he showed that there's something that bodies in the heavens that revolved around something other than the Earth. And that was a huge break from the dogma of the day.
And he named them Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto.
Who later went on to star in Ally McBeal.
But that's another story for another time.
So we're off to a great start in 2009, a new year of the SGU.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Jay's over-the-top British accent, by the way, is a reaction to an email we got from one of our British listeners who wanted to know why we're always cracking these terrible British accents.
I thought that was actually quite subtle for Jay.
his email was more than that.
Rather nuanced.
It not only was, why do you always make fun of the British accents, but why don't you make more fun of the Irish or the Scottish accents? Okay. Right. See you, V. Much.
Like
also,
and apparently I said kitten with an accent. I don't think I did that.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
That's my actual voice, okay? Maybe I just say kitten like a, you know, like a Brit.
If the emailer actually was upset about that, I mean, we do it in total jest. If anything, we don't mean anything bad by it in any way. I love England. I love British people.
It's just one of the whimsical quirks of the SGU.
I mean, if anything, it's just like a habit now. You know, I just whip it out when don't even think about it.
What our listeners don't know is that, you know, behind the scenes, Jay does a very wicked German accent.
It's true. It's really his best.
Von Wulfit.
Maybe for the rest of this episode, we'll only make fun of German accents.
Yeah, I think that's
Nine.
Fair.
Why limit ourselves?
Yeah. Do you have your papers?
Und? Hogan!
Have you guys ever heard anyone make fun of an American English accent?
Yes.
That wasn't from the U.S.? I love it.
Yeah, I do love it.
Yeah,
that's true.
Don't you remember forcing as many British guests as possible to do an American accent?
Why?
Were you?
By Jove.
At TAM?
Yeah, I have. I do. I remember.
Yeah, only German this episode, Jay.
Yeah,
when we were in Italy that one time, there were these like teenagers behind us on a bus, and they were saying ice cream, pizza.
And Pepsi.
And making fun of English accent, American accent.
Of course, in Italy, it's all about the food, you know.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah, right, Jay, right.
All right, well, the first episode of every year we dedicate to looking back at the predictions that were made for the previous year to see how they did. So how did our would-be Nostradamuses or prognosticators do for 2008? I predict that they did pretty bad.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Who have you guys looked into? Who do you have for
I looked into Sylvia Brown.
All right, we'll start with her. Start with Sylvia.
She did. She had a hit with Britney Spears, I think. She says Britney Spears ought to be on medication because of a bipolar condition. She's surrounded by yes people, so no one will tell her the truth.
How was that a hit? Was that a hit?
We all pretty much knew that Britney Spears was having some type of emotional problems and everything.
Yeah, but that was she was all, actually, this was her comeback year, if anything.
Yeah. She also said Lindsay Lohan is going to shape up her life this year.
And did that happen?
Well, she's slightly less crazy.
But that's just regression to the mean. Anybody could have predicted that.
She said the troops are going to start
Take
coming
that,
home
Lilo.
In increments because all the other countries are bailing out.
We have not started bringing home the troops yet, so that's a fail.
She got a hit here. Now, this one's stretching it, but she said Bush's approval ratings will get even lower.
Okay.
She said a Democrat will win the presidency, which that was pretty much.
So she couldn't even bring herself to decide which Democrat. I mean, everyone but Ann Coulter knew that a Democrat was going to win this year, right? And she couldn't even put her nickel down on, you know, Barack or Clinton or somebody else.
Isn't that ridiculous?
She said the housing market will get stronger.
Wouldn't you just give up your psychic powers if all it's given you is like a Democrat's going to win? It wouldn't even tell you who. It's like, come on, you could do better than that.
Well, Bob, she did say the job market's going to get better.
Oh, that's good to know.
Now, I don't know how this is a prediction, but she said, look at medical stocks, but don't do any investing unless you research. You'd be better off rolling the dice. That's kind of what she does with her predictions, I think.
Yeah, that's a non-prediction.
And then she said, there will be diabetic breakthroughs and the use of sound waves to treat cancer. There is a type of flu that will be resistant to everything. Then this is one of the ones I found interesting. She said, whooping cough, mumps, and measles will rise because of people who don't want to get their kids vaccinated.
Yeah, that was already happening.
And she said, vaccines will be proven not to cause autism.
Old news. There was nothing really especially
I feel dirty, though. Like, oh, she's not an anti-vaccinationist. Awesome. Like, that makes me feel dirty to think that there's something positive about Sylvia Brown.
Okay, got a couple more, and then I'm done with her. We're going to have more tsunamis and a big earthquake in Japan. And then here's my favorite one. Long-dead volcanoes will erupt all over the country.
Yeah, I don't remember that happening, actually.
Well, she meant a volcano of the mind in a metaphoric kind of way.
And also, did you guys notice that she got a facelift at some point over the last year?
I don't think I've seen her in the last year. Every year, there are predictions that there are going to be earthquakes here or there, more earthquakes or significant earthquakes or whatever. And that's, of course, the high probability hit. It sounds specific, but really, you know, if I pulled up the website, the U.S. government website on the Earthquake Hazards Program, and they actually list all the significant earthquakes for 2008. There were 41 noteworthy earthquakes in 2001. All over the world, in all of the earthquake hotspots that exist. So all you have to do is say, there's going to be an earthquake in Northern California, and you'll be right every year. Or you could say there's going to be an earthquake in Japan. You know, you'll be right every year, because that's just, there are earthquakes all the time in along the faults where earthquakes occur.
That's why when I'm looking for good predictions, I like to go to the Coast to Coast crowd. Because they take chances.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know, Coast to Coast is the crazy middle-of-the-night radio show that is hosted by George Norrie, formerly hosted by Art Bell. And it's brilliant. And every year they ask their listeners to call in and give their predictions. So here are a few from that were predictions for 2008 that I particularly liked. One listener warned of a big disease coming from crows. That didn't happen.
Is that crows?
Crows.
A murder of crows?
Yeah.
Someone was murdered?
One person quite optimistically predicted that there would be no hurricanes over North America in 2008 at all.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. One person quite pessimistically predicted a steamroller accident in Charleston, South Carolina will take many lives, which really makes one wonder what a steamroller would have to be doing.
What was he watching Bugs Bunny at the time that he made that movie?
You know, the thing is, have you ever seen a steamroller in action? They don't roll that fast. I mean, wait, that reminds
really
me of that
don't.
Movie. Wasn't there some guy like running in front
a
of
a fish called Wanda?
Yeah, yes, and he was screaming.
Oh no!
Maybe there was a tar spill at the same time, or like a maple syrup explosion, and everyone was stuck, and then the steamroller
That's got to be a joke.
Several things would have to come together to really make that one happen. But
that's a perfect storm of ineptitude.
Exactly. But fortunately for Charleston, South Carolina, it did not happen. Art Bell himself predicted that Al Gore would jump into the presidential race at the last moment. That did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
And my absolute favorite coast-to-coast prediction of 2008 was, lightning will become sentient and attack people.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Which I don't believe happened, but
that's awesome.
Maybe I missed that.
We'd release. Have to really be out of the news cycle not to have heard about that. Wait, wasn't that a science or fiction from earlier in the year?
I think I got that one wrong, actually.
Rebecca, I heard what you said, but my mind like erased it immediately. I can't even remember like the detail. I just remember something about being attacked.
Yeah, it's that
when lightning attacks.
All I'm saying is, you know, stay inside during the next electrical storm.
I've got a few funny ones. This is from angelsandghosts.com, angelsghosts.com. These are so this is a more of an out there predictions website. And I actually went into the, you know, the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive to pull them from the beginning of the year to make sure that they were actually posted up, you know, in early 2008. These are the ones that they have on their homepage. An earthquake will hit Northern California in the spring. Again, earthquake. Osama bin Laden will end jihad. Did not happen. The Mothman will be spotted in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Food prices will rise.
Ooh.
Oh, that was kind of old news, wasn't it? A UFO will be shot down.
Yeah, of course, and crash in a lake.
It's not a UFO anymore.
If it were, the government would hide it and we wouldn't know about it, right?
They'd call it a weather balloon.
Black Triangle UFOs will turn out to be new U.S. stealth fighters.
Wow, that's cool.
As if they weren't before.
You guys know Barbara Garcia?
No.
So she's
Jerry's wife. Against
self-proclaimed psychic who makes predictions every year. She had a couple of doozies. So these were very lame predictions. So, and as we discuss usually when we talk about these predictions, there's a few typical strategies that they use. The high probability predictions that are almost certain to come true, but sound more specific than they really are. Vague predictions that can be made to fit so many different outcomes that you can then, in retrospect, claim, well, that's what I meant all along. Or occasionally they will throw out some very specific predictions, hoping to get lucky, but they make a lot of them, and then they will encourage your remembering the hits and forgetting the misses, or simply non-predictions, just making us like Sylvia Brown's that Jay read a moment ago, some kind of a statement that's not really predicting anything. Like, watch medical stocks. That's not a prediction. But here are Barbara Garcia's for 2008. It is a turbulent year in natural disasters, particularly tidal waves, possibly a tsunami. It is not unusual to see earthquakes and slides here in California, but it is rather unusual to see several scattered around the world all in one year. Yeah, like, as I said, 41 in 2008, and that's an average year. Then she says, good grief, the hurricanes are just wild next year. So I guess she was watching Charlie Brown. Global warming has long been a major concern worldwide, and finally, the United States will become a team player in support of scientific efforts. So I don't know what specifically that would refer to.
It's some kind of half-assed political statement on her part.
Then the presidential, you know, I looked at the presidential election, see, you know, who was making presidential election predictions for 2008. There was no real pattern. In fact, I was surprised at how many people got it wrong. But this is her prediction, you know, very wishy-washy. Election years have always been exciting years for Americans. I am expecting to see many twists and turns in the upcoming elections before the Republicans give way to our new Democratic leader. So she jumps on the bandwagon of predicting what everyone knew was going to happen. Yeah. There will be events in the world that leave us wondering if we will even have an election. Really? Back in the year 1999, I had stated in my forecast, in the first 15 years of the new millennium, a woman will be named president of the United States. Psychic predictions are not fixed and can be altered.
Nice out.
Nice escape hatch. We can certainly alter this one. The candidates all look promising, and wow, check out who Oprah is supporting. How cool is that? Yeah, she supported Barack.
That's an awesome safety net. I didn't know you could do that in the psychic world.
A New Planet is one of the of those grand discoveries in 2008, as well as an extraordinary discovery right here on Earth, as remains of an ancient being are uncovered. Could this be proof of the existence of E.T.? So A New Planet, you know, we've been discovering dozens of planets every year, you know, extrasolar planets. There haven't been any, obviously, planets in our own solar system discovered. And no one dug up E.T. in 2008. Although they got close with the Bigfoot in the icebox. Which, of course, always brings up the counterpoint to this, which is what the psychics did not predict. You would think the big dramatic events would have a lot of psychic reverberations, you know.
Yeah, like when lightning became sentient and started killing people.
Yeah. Somebody would have bothered to make a notation in the Akashic Files, you know, that this big thing was coming in 2008. But nobody predicted the global financial meltdown. They were sort of nibbling around, basically extrapolating meekly from what was happening in 2007, but nobody came close to saying that there was going to be the financial meltdown that we had.
That's right. They don't go for extremes, Steve. They stay close to the middle, and it's a safer bet.
Or they go wacky, right?
Over the top.
Yeah, because they're just trying to get the headlines for what they're predicting. They're not really. I don't think they really expect that.
Don't you think that is such a huge, gargantuan miss like that? You think that would undermine some people's confidence in psychic predictions a bit?
What's the rationalizations that people would use in that situation? They'll say what they always say is that, you know, psychic predictions is not a perfect science, right? It's an inexact science. So
yeah, it's hit or miss individually, but when you got thousands of psychics, you think somebody would have grabbed it.
I want to hear things that aren't like kind of based on trends that are already happening, you know, like anything you can extrapolate from, that's obviously you trying to pull it out of the trend, like I said. You know, I want to hear about a totally irregular death like, what's his face?
Heath Ledger.
Yeah, like nobody brought that up. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, that'll probably happen as soon as psychic powers exist. So mm-hmm. Just wait for that.
Well, we should make our own predictions, right? For this year?
Yeah, does anybody want to make predictions for 2009?
I predict I will rock harder than I rocked last year.
Oh, God, don't you just see? There's a trend.
Talk about
just
vague.
The trend.
How do we document that?
But the trend works for me. It worked last year.
That was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Go with the hot hand.
No, I had an asteroid named after me. Rock harder? Flying through space. It doesn't get much rockier than that.
And how did we do last year? What predictions of ours came true?
I think I was 0-3.
I predicted Oprah would come up with a new form of BS, and a listener wrote in to say that it came true.
Something tells me you're going to predict that again this year.
Yes, in February, Michelle from Detroit emailed us, and she said, I'm not sure if anyone has pointed this out to you yet, but on your first show of the year, Rebecca predicted that Oprah would be peddling a new form of bullcrap. About 2 weeks later, Oprah announced that she will be launching her own TV network. This is a new format for her to peddle her old and new bullcrap 24/7. I feel this constitutes a hit on Rebecca's part, so congratulations. Thank you, Michelle.
Bob, didn't you make a prediction about the
petaflop? Yes, I did.
The petaflop.
Yeah, I think I missed it by, I don't know, a couple months or so.
Missed it by that much.
Couple flops.
I think I predict that by early 2009 we would hit around 180 episodes.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Lucky guess. I predict that they're going to turn on the LHC and they're not going to find the Higgs boson, but they are going to find something awesome.
Really? Wow! I don't know whether to hope you'll be right or wrong.
It will blow your mind, whatever it is. I'm pretty sure.
Cool. I predict there are going to be new scientific discoveries in 2009.
Shut up, Steve. Come on. Seriously? Right.
No old ones, huh?
That's right. No old discoveries, only new ones.
Predict something about a bird.
Okay, I'll predict that we will not find definitive evidence for the ivory-billed woodpecker in 2009.
That's a stupid prediction.
Wow, you're really stretching it, Steve. Everybody's got to pick a celebrity death. Somebody, come on.
You brought this up last year.
I did, and I remember just now, and I'm gonna stick with Britney Spears. I think that was my pick last year. I'm going to go with her death this year.
Britney Mine's Spears. Michael Jackson all the way.
Oh, you know what? He's not doing so well, huh?
You can't take it. I already got it.
I'll take Ozzy Osbourne.
Okay.
Oh, good one, Steve. I don't think I would have thought of that. I say, unfortunately, the Mixer. Mickey Rooney. We're going to lose him this year.
Mickey Rooney.
I got a few predictions here.
Which Frank, one's yeah. he?
Frank, I was surprised he's to know not he was
the,
still alive.
He's not the angry one on 60 Minutes, is he?
No, that's
Andy Rooney.
Andy Rooney, yeah. He could go too, actually.
So you get partial credit for Andy Rooney.
All right, I'll run through mine real quick, and you can just stop me if you want to make a comment here, all right?
Stop.
Yes, your comment, Rebecca?
No, I
yeah, right.
just wanted to say stop.
She's just testing. Go ahead.
Test. Is this thing on? An enormous breakthrough in solar energy storage technology as the capacity to store harnessed energy will double from today's current limitations.
Boring. Next.
100 new exoplanets will be discovered.
100?
100.
That's a lot.
Not just one. 100. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, but they're looking.
For 1 year.
How many did we discover this year?
I think it's 300 in total, is it?
57 exoplanets were discovered in 2008.
No sweat. I think we can crack the 100 mark. A long-lost piece of classical music composition by Beethoven will be revealed.
Ooh, wait.
Now, when I made this prediction, I had actually had Mozart in there. And then Jennifer, my wife, looked up online. She said she thought that she heard a recent news story on that. And back in September of 2008, there was a piece of Mozart music that was uncovered.
Oh, my God. You predicted it after it happened. So it's like
you retrodicted. Awesome.
Totally use some sort of time travel technique.
So I changed that to Beethoven. It was easy. Chicago Cubs will win the World Series. Shark attacks on people will increase by 100%.
What the hell? Who said that?
Leaving scientists baffled.
Who said that?
Yeah, it'll go from 15 to 30.
You predict that shark attacks will go up 100%? What are you, a psycho?
Psychic. Ick. Not O.
Oh, that's right. Ick. I always confuse those two.
Terrorists will attack a U.S. warship, first since the bombing of the Cole in 2000. Solar activity will continue to be low for the first half of the year and then regain its normal activity in the second half of the year.
Thank goodness, because we're going to have all those crazy solar panels.
Well, we're going to need them. U.S. President Obama will be the first president to set foot upon Antarctica.
Antarctica.
I thought you were going to say Mars. Yeah. That would have been more interesting.
A missing link of dolphin evolution will be unearthed and identified. Elements numbers 120 and, of course, 119 will be created.
Two of them in 1 year?
Well, don't you have to have 119 to get to 120?
No, I don't think so.
And finally, a new airspeed record for non-space vehicles will be set.
Eclipsing by a shark.
Eclipsing, no, by an airplane. Eclipsing the 7,546 miles per hour cheat, which was achieved in 2004. And there you go.
I got three. Somebody's going to make a 1 terabyte solid state hard drive by December 5th, 2009, with crazy read-write speeds. I guess that's almost a no-brainer. Gas in the United States will reach $1 a gallon. I don't know when, but sometime in 2009. And I also predict that measles outbreaks throughout the entire developed world will explode like it's never been before.
First news item, scientists discover true love.
To blame.
Aww.
So these are a team finally. From Stony Brook University in New York using brain scans, looking at the reaction of the brain to couples. So when they show like one member of a couple a picture of their partner, then they see what kind of response does the brain have. Now, typically in the first 9 to 12, maybe 15 months of a relationship, when you're in the in love phase of a relationship, you have certain biochemical reaction just to the image of your romantic partner. The pleasure hormones get released in certain parts of the brain. But then that response begins to attenuate, it fades away, and then after about 15 months, it's not seen anymore. So the conventional wisdom was that biochemical in love process only lasts for about a year or so, and that longer term relationships are built upon other things than that sort of biochemical in love. However, what this new research shows is that a certain percentage of long-term relationships, they found that about 1 in 10, or about 10% of mature couples, exhibited the same chemical reactions when shown photographs of their loved ones as is seen in this early stage of the relationship. So they are, you know, calling these couples swans because swans mate for life. It's an interesting finding that that definitely is new and contradicts what was, you know, previously believed from prior research.
So it's still a little bit depressing because it's 1 out of 10 of couples that have been together for a long time. So, I mean, how many couples stay, like what percentage of couples even stay married that long, let alone, you know, and then of those, you only take 1 out of 10 that are actually, you know, in the fast heartbeat kind of
the oogie feeling.
Love.
Yeah.
Oogie. Yeah.
I find this whole area of research very interesting because you think about like what are the evolutionary pressures that led to this kind of biochemistry, and you know obviously you can always in retrospect make sense out of it. And as with everything in biology, there's variation. You know, there was variation pretty much in any characteristic that you look at. So it's not surprising that some subset of people have reactions that are different than typical. But it also, I think, meets the common experience that, you know, of how people feel at the beginning of a relationship. And then, you know, as time goes on, if you're going to make a relationship work for decades, which is probably was not common among our evolutionary ancestors, right? You have a...
Well, we died when we were 40.
You have a life expectancy of 40. You know, probably not many couples celebrating their 50th anniversary, you know, back in the Stone Age.
And was there even monogamy going on back then?
Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, clearly we, you know, our ancestors evolved to be pair bonding. That's our mating strategy, our dominant mating strategy. Though, you know, some cultures have polygamy, but pair bonding is a dominant sort of mating strategy for Homo sapiens, and that certainly involves strategies like this biochemical and love thing, like pheromones. And also, for example, certain biological interactions like, you know, a mother breastfeeding or cuddling their child, or, you know, sex certainly causes the release of oxytocin, which has been described as the...
Is that what it's called, that oxytocin?
Yeah, oxytocin is the bonding, you know, neurotransmitter that triggers...
It's also what's released after orgasm.
That's right. So you can get that in love feeling back, you know, from like having sex, because that actually releases oxytocin, which stimulates a similar kind of response. And that these are presumed to be evolved mechanisms to maintain, you know, a monogamous relationship, because then the couple can invest in their children, and the male can be reasonably confident that the children are his children, so that to justify his, you know, intense investment of time and resources into them. That's how the story is all put together.
Well, yeah, I think it'd be interesting if they found out exactly why. Like, is it just biological? Is it something that these people are doing that's different than what other people are doing?
Yeah.
You know,
I think here's one thing that struck me. If this is seen in both members of each of these 10% of the couples.
Yeah, explain that.
Yeah, that suggests that this isn't just 100% genetic. Because then what are the odds that the swans,
right,
quote-unquote swans, will always find each other and never hook up?
Well, maybe the odds are 1 out of 10.
With a non-swan. Well, the odds would be a lot higher than that.
Well, I just mean, like, what if it's something that when these two sort of people with a similar genetic makeup meet, it activates whatever they're...
Yeah, I mean,
detecting.
That may be a factor, but it seems unlikely that that would be enough to ensure... that all of the couples would be swan with swan and non-swan with non-swan. You know what I mean?
Well, I just mean, like, in this study, maybe they wouldn't detect it if it was swan with non-swan. I really hate using those words. It makes me feel like we're talking about a reality TV dating show thing. Like, oh, you're a swan. You get to stay on for another week.
Well, good research creates more questions than it answers. So I think that these are all sub-questions that I'd like to see further explored.
So you're saying that people can't love each other past a year?
No, it's not that they can't love each other.
Correct.
It's they don't have that biochemical, you know, mood-altering, crazy in love experience. They can have a mature, long-term, you know, loving relationship, and that gets reinforced in a lot of ways. It's just there's just that one component of it that sort of just by being in the same room with them, you get butterflies in your stomach. That kind of stuff only lasts for a certain amount of time, apparently, in most people.
I've been in relationships where it lasted longer than a year.
Yeah.
You're a freak.
People are different.
Maybe you're a swan, Jay.
It lasts about 3 years for me.
3 years?
And then you're done?
Thus far. And I'm done. Well, I guess it depends on the person.
It's good to know.
I'm just saying, judging on past history, that's
all. That's really not a good sign, to be honest.
Well, let's go on to the next news item. There's been a lot of discussion in the last week over the death of John Travolta's son. A lot of questions, a lot of innuendo. Rebecca, you blogged about this.
I did. It's a really sad story all around. John Travolta is married to Kelly Preston, and both of them are Scientologists. And they had a son, a teenage son, named Jet, who died on New Year's Day while they were on vacation. And Jet has long had some kind of disability that has been the subject of a bit of controversy. Even before his death, the Travoltas claimed that when Jet was a baby, he was exposed to some household cleaners, and that gave him a very rare condition called
Kawasaki's disease.
Yeah. And the problem is that the symptoms that Jet was showing didn't really quite fit in with Kawasaki disease, and the way that Jet behaved seemed an awful lot like he was autistic. And the reason why there was so much speculation about this was because of the Travoltas' religion. Scientology rejects any kind of mention of psychological impairments. They believe that everything, any kind of mental disorder, is just literally all in your head, that you're just making it up. It's psychosomatic, and the way to fix it is by going through Scientology courses as opposed to getting treatment from a trained psychiatrist or getting actual medication. So Jet went untreated for autism. They treated him for Kawasaki disease, supposedly, and he ended up having a seizure while they were on vacation and died. So that's one part. The other part is that the people who were hired to look after Jet were two friends of the Travoltas who had no medical training or no they didn't have any experience taking care of a child. They're both Scientologists as well, high-level Scientologists like the Travoltas. And now it's all kind of being swept under the table by the Scientologists. They're all claiming that the seizures came from the Kawasaki disease. Doctors are weighing in and saying that that's just very unlikely at this point. And it all looks really fishy. So ultimately, we can probably never say exactly what was wrong with Jet. He was cremated, by the way. There's never going to be any complete, you know, medical examination that's released to the public. There's literally no way to say for sure. There's only conjecture. So we can make an educated guess on what happened, but no matter what, it's kind of sad. And it had at least a little bit to do with the Scientology angle, if for no other reason than the fact that his caretakers were completely untrained and their only qualification was as Scientologists.
Yeah, obviously it's an incredibly sad story. You know, I can't talk about any story where someone's child dies without thinking of that angle of it. But, you know, again, there is this hint in this story of this, you know, cautionary tale about, you know, having an extreme ideology interfere with just looking at the facts for what they are. If you cannot admit the concept of mental or psychiatric illness in your thinking about the world, well, then, you know, that's a huge blind spot.
Yeah, and Scientology has a really long track record of people dying because they don't receive adequate medical care for their mental conditions. So people like Lisa McPherson, who died in 1995, she was a Scientologist with psychological issues, and she died under very mysterious circumstances in which she was in the hospital, but Scientologists removed her for several days. She disappeared, and when she reappeared, she was underweight, dehydrated, covered in bruises, and, you know, dead with no real investigation into it and no no real answers from it. And she's just one of literally dozens of cases of Scientologists mm-hmm. with serious mental conditions who don't get the treatment that they need.
Rebecca, I read in a few different places that the Travoltas did, in fact, give Jet for quite some time anti-seizure medication. I just wanted to clear that up. It seemed from what I could gather that they, at least for the seizure aspect of his condition, they were fairly aggressive to a certain degree, at least, and they gave him the anti-seizure medications, and they worked great for a while. And at some point, the effectiveness went way down, and then they pulled that medication. They stopped giving him that medication.
Because of the side effects, they said that the side effects were too great, apparently.
Supposedly, the seizure medication was affecting his liver, and so they had to stop it.
Well, I mean, the reports that I heard was that the medication he was on, the anti-seizure medication, was Depakote, valproic acid.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can cause liver damage. That's one of the possible side effects. It's uncommon, but it happens, and when it happens, it can't be severe. And the treatment mm-hmm. is to... You know, we monitor patients for any liver reaction, and then if they start to have it, the response is to take them off the medication. But there are lots of newer, safer anti-seizure medications that do not have liver toxicity as a side effect. So that would have just prompted putting him on a different medication.
Or it seems at least having him in the care of somebody who's trained to deal with seizures and react if something happens. Yeah.
So still a lot of uncertainty, a lot that's unknown, but the story is not really holding together the way it's being reported so far. There was also a similar tragic story of a recent death in the context of an ideological belief system. Christine Maggiore, who is one of the leaders of the HIV denial community, died recently, actually on December 26th. Now, Christine Maggiore was diagnosed as HIV positive and then became convinced by Peter Duisberg and others that HIV does not cause AIDS and that AIDS is caused by other things, lifestyle, diet, or toxicity or whatever, and not the human immunodeficiency virus, and further came to drink the Kool-Aid, as we say, and believe that the HIV story is a product of big pharma and evil government, uncaring, stupid, or unimaginative doctors. What I call the casual assumption of moral and intellectual superiority on the part of the HIV deniers. And she did not treat her own disease. Actually, far more tragic, in my opinion, although her death is tragic, far more tragic than her own death was that several years ago, her 3-year-old daughter, Eliza, died of HIV-related pneumonia.
Which is preventable,
oh,
right?
Totally. Christine did not take medication while she was pregnant to reduce the risk of transmission of HIV. She breastfed Eliza, even though that increases the risk of transmission without taking medication. She refused to have Eliza or her... She also is survived by a son. Refused to have either of them tested for HIV and claimed that they were perfectly healthy. In fact, she was claiming that even weeks before Eliza, essentially turned up on death's door at the hospital and died very soon after that of an advanced case of a specific type of pneumonia that is known to be an opportunistic infection that commonly occurs in AIDS, pneumocystic pneumonia. This was proven by the autopsy report. The autopsy report is, and I read the whole autopsy report, is unequivocal. It's absolutely unequivocal. Her death was caused by pneumocystis carinii pneumonia caused by AIDS. She also had, Eliza, at 3 years old, also had AIDS dementia. She had changes in her brain due to chronic HIV infection. It was as clear as can be. Now, of course, once you get to that point where you're arguably your own child's death was caused by your belief system, there's just absolutely no way you're going to admit that you were wrong. And your culpability. Yeah. It's just that's, I think, beyond most people. She just dug in deeper, and the HIV community dug in deeper, and they trumped up ridiculous accusations that the Eliza's death was actually caused by an allergic reaction to amoxicillin, which is absurd. It's just, it really is, without going into all the details, it's just absurd. that these multiple rare things, you know, could all explain to various aspects of the autopsy. It was really, you know, an incredible, you know, like hand waving job of denial, basically just flat out denial.
And so, she left a son as well, didn't she?
Yeah, yeah. She's survived by a son and a husband now as well.
Steve, you said she brought her daughter to the hospital at death's door. So did her denial extend to ignoring obvious life-threatening illness? I mean, not something subtle that she, you know, she may or may not have, but obvious illnesses?
She wasn't denying medical illness that exists. I mean, so I think she was seeking treatment for her daughter's illness, for just being sick, for having a cold or having pneumonia, just denied that she had HIV or wouldn't let her get tested for it, wouldn't let her get treated for it. So without treating the HIV, and if you have advanced AIDS, you're not going to be able to fight off an overwhelming pneumonia, especially if you're a young child. And now, a few years later, now Christine Maggiore, who always denied that she had AIDS, even though that she said she was tested HIV positive, that she denied that she ever had AIDS, died again. And like the Travolta case, we're not getting all the information. We know that she had pneumonia earlier this year. It certainly sounds like she probably died of an opportunistic pneumonia, but this information is not being released. You know, I have no medical records or anything have come to light. So I think they're trying to conceal the details of exactly why she died. But the big suspicion is that she was otherwise a young woman without any other disease, any other reason to die. She was 52, you know, when she died. You know, 52-year-olds don't typically die of pneumonia. But that would be a very common way to go for somebody who was an untreated HIV positive. I got to say, you know, we deal with a lot of wackiness, and the HIV denial crowd is among the most pernicious. They are really a mean, nasty, very self-righteous, incredibly frustrating group of people. They also have a habit of essentially spamming and raiding any blog that talks about HIV or HIV denial. You know, they descend upon it. So, like, I typically rack up 10 or 20 comments on a typical blog of mine. When I blogged about Christine Maggiore, I have 136 as of today comments. It's all just HIV deniers, you know, coming in like a swarm. Same thing happens on Tara Smith's website or ORAC or on Science Based Medicine. Whenever we touch upon the HIV topic, they just swoop in and really just spew forth utter nonsense and in an incredibly arrogant and nasty way. So the community really is extremely despicable. And they have one of those pseudosciences that has a body count, because they're telling people, don't get treated for HIV. It's all a big conspiracy lie. Take our supplements and vitamins, and that's all you need.
Okay, so that was a downer.
That was a bit of a downer, but we're going to go to another medical one, but this one's a bit of an upper. This one's
good.
This is a very positive tale of some noble work being done by our skeptical colleagues across the pond in the UK. Recently, a group called Sense About Science.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually, we may be interviewing someone from this group next week, so I'm not going to go too much into the group itself, because we probably will be talking about it. But this is a group of young scientists in the UK who decided to form a group, and they have a trust, actually. And their goal is to educate the public about scientific issues. Sense About Science. They're basically a skeptical group. That's essentially the mission that they're undertaking. And recently, they've set their sights on the craze about detoxification. The whole detox nonsense. And they reviewed a number of products that all claim to be to detox. And the basic idea here is that it's based upon the premise that a lot of ailments and illnesses and symptoms are caused by the fact that our bodies are being assaulted by numerous toxins that are artificial and a product of our industrialized civilization, and we didn't evolve to deal with them. So you need some help, right? You need some magical product, whatever they're selling, will detox your body. It'll take the toxins out. Now, either some products don't mention any specific toxins. They just sort of refer to them vaguely, nor do they give any specific notion about how their product is supposed to detoxify. Or they will list specific toxins, like mercury obviously is a very common one that gets mentioned, but they don't and can't provide any evidence to show that their product actually removes mercury or whatever toxin they mention from the body. So they never close the loop, right? They're not talking about a known toxin causing a known biological effect with a mechanism of detoxification that actually, with evidence that it actually removes the toxin from the body and results in an improved health outcome. There is no product out there with the label detox on it that has that actual chain of evidence, anything even close to it. They don't even come close to closing the loop that way. They just are, what Sense About Science demonstrated is that they're just slapping the label detox on there as a marketing tool, and it's utterly meaningless. My favorite example that they mentioned, and this was covered by the BBC, and they did a great job of interfacing with the media, was a company that markets a cleanser, like a facial cleanser, you know, like a swab. And they called it a detox cleanser. But when you actually read the fine print, what they're talking about is that it removes dirt and dead skin cells. That's how it's detoxing.
That's considered detox.
Yeah,
now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just like every other cleanser in the world, right? So that's rendering the term meaningless, like the term natural has been rendered meaningless by its abuse and marketing, for example.
And on the same topic of the detox, Ben Goldacre recently kicked the can of this total pseudoscientist who was on, I think it was BBC Radio.
Yes, BBC Radio, yep.
Yeah, the girl was doing a detox in a box is the name of the company, and this woman runs it, and she's got her name followed by MD on the website, but when you click on her name, you see that MD stands for Managing Director.
Right. This is Nas Amir Ahmadi is her name.
Yeah.
And from Detox in a Box. Yeah.
So Ben calls her out on the fact that right on her website, Detox in a Box promises to rid your body of heavy metals like mercury and cadmium, which he points out she spelled wrong on the website. And she says, oh, no, that's not on our website. You've got that wrong. And he says, no, I'm pretty sure this is the exact quote right here. And she says, no, you're thinking of some other website. We don't promise that. We're all about just all natural, healthy food. And
Ben's not a marketing director.
Ben, as a proper skeptic, says, well, all right, let me check on that and get back to you. And turns out Ben was 100% right, and she was 100% lying through her teeth to millions of people.
Scores.
Well, maybe not millions. Thousands, let's say. I don't know how many people.
A lot of people.
Maybe they have millions. Anyway, a lot of
people. Say 10.
On the radio. 10 people.
million people.
That's enough. Live on the radio. And the BBC, to their credit, later came back on and said, to those of you who were listening earlier, turns out the doctor was right.
Yeah, and Ben did put it on his website right after the interview.
Yeah, with a screenshot and everything, because she immediately went on and deleted any reference to the heavy metals and things like that.
Yes, so. Scumbag.
She knew it.
Listen to the audio. Ben links to it on his site. I blogged about it, so you can get to all the links through Neurologica as well. It was a funny exchange, and Ben did a great job. It's fun to listen to him because he cuts to the chase. He's very cutting, but he still has that equanimity and that very calm sort of approach that I think is extremely effective. He did seem to be taken aback briefly by the fact that she was just flat out lying about what was on her website. I mean, you don't usually expect to be hit with just the bold-faced lie. A different representative of the detox in a box, which the quickie is that it's a meal preparation service. They deliver prepared meals to you, and they claim that because of the special nature of their meals, that it's all natural and whatever, that it helps the body detoxify itself.
And it costs something like £400 a month.
It's ridiculously expensive. So it's Ben said, just buy fruits and veggies from your market to save yourself a lot of money. So a different representative from the Detox in a Box went up against the representative from Sense About Science, and it was comical trying to listen to this person weasel their way around the claim. She didn't want to say that the food did anything it didn't do, but at the same time she was trying to make it sound like the food helped the body detoxify itself when it was clear that it didn't do anything. And even the interviewers were sort of on to her, saying like, so you're saying that it's no different than any well-balanced meal. So, oh no, it helps the body, the liver and the kidney. And how does it do that? And no, really, again, the gobbledygook comes out then. Yeah. Just trying to make the non-claims sound
frantic
impressive.
BSing.
Yeah. To anyone familiar with the shtick, it was comical. So that I agree, Rebecca. That's a total in the win column for Ben Goldacre and for Sense About Science and for the skepticism in the UK, and an absolute fail for the detox, you know, snake oil losers. So that was a good one. Well, we have two more news items coming up. We have a very, very brief news item that Bob is going to tell us about. Very brief. It'll only take a second.
Starting now.
Leap seconds. Done. Oh. Did you guys, did New Year's Eve seem to be a little bit longer last week?
Yeah.
A little bit. Tiny.
Well,
yes.
Well, it was. It was shorter. 1 second longer. They did that thing where they insert a leap second into the day.
Nice.
And I thought it was an interesting story I wanted to cover. Basically, a leap second is like a leap year, leap day. They're throwing in an extra second, only it's a lot smaller than a leap. Well, that was stupid.
Now he's panicking. You laugh, but I did hear, I heard someone on a news show actually say that. It's like a leap year, only smaller. Thank you, newsman. Thank you.
I'm in a high.
So what you're saying is the second is smaller.
How often do we get leap seconds?
Every 500 days or so. It depends. It's irregular. On average, every 500 days, pretty much. Although there is no timetable like we have with leap days and leap years. So basically, the reason we have leap seconds is that scientists are trying to reconcile two major ways that we measure time in terms of days and years. One is the spin of the Earth and the rotation of the Earth around the Sun, and the other is atomic time using atomic clocks. Atomic clocks, as we know, are extremely accurate. They lose less than a billionth of a second a day. But because Earth, the rotation, the spin of the Earth is slowing down because, for various reasons, including tidal friction, it's slowing down and we're losing about 0.02 of a second a day. In fact, many, many millions of years ago, our days were only about 10 hours. Mm-hmm. So our days are slowly getting longer and longer. So what happens is that when the discrepancy between these two ways of timekeeping reaches about a second, the International Earth Rotation and Reference System Service in Frankfurt, they step in. So what they do is they communicate with the 50 national laboratories around the world that collectively run about 300 atomic clocks, and they tell these people that, hey, it's time to adjust, it's time to throw in a leap second.
They say, add ein second. Sorry.
What I found, I knew a lot about this stuff about leap seconds. What really surprised me was that
I'm sorry, we're out of time, people, Bob. We're going to have to go on to the next segment.
Yeah, but let us know when the next leap. Oh, okay.
One interesting thing I discovered was that a lot of people they want to get rid of the leap second. They say, let's forget the leap second and let's just make it a leap minute next century. Mm-hmm. Because there are some downsides, some problems with, sometimes cell phones can crash and GPS devices can crash if they're not programmed to expect them. And a lot of people think that they're just, it's an inconvenience and we should just get rid of it. They're actually going to discuss this in a couple of years.
It's kind of like getting rid of the penny,
so maybe,
right?
It might be the last leap second that we have, so wow. I hope you enjoyed it.
The last leap second.
Wow. It took forever.
We hardly knew ye.
One more brief news item. The nominations for the Weblog Awards 2008 are open. Unfortunately, the timing was really bad in terms of this podcast, so the nominations and the finalists are in, so now there's open voting on the finalists to see who's going to win the Weblog Awards as well as the Medical Blog Awards in various categories. They opened on Tuesday, so several days ago, if you're listening to this podcast over the weekend, but they will be open until Tuesday afternoon, so you'll have a few days, you know, to vote. The way the voting works is you can vote once per day for each category. And that's per IP address. So it's kind of an odd voting system, but that's the way it works. In the Weblog Awards has a science blog category. Both Bad Astronomy and Feringula have been on the list among the finalists for many years. And this year, for the first time, Neurologica, my personal blog, made it into the top 10, into the finalists for science blogs.
Yay.
Yep, so we're all in the mix. And of course, you know, we'd like to ask our listeners to vote for your favorite science blog.
Vote for Steve.
Actually, you know, in all honesty, you know, obviously, he'd be happy to win, but I just like everyone to vote for their favorite science blog.
Oh, set the modesty aside.
Like the global warming denying site. blog?
Well, there is. You know,
we need to beat the global.
Last year and this year, there are a couple of blogs in the science blog category that are dedicated to the notion that global warming is not real, and they're in the lead right now. So they've. And, you know, the thing is, you know, anyone could get nominated, and getting picked to be a finalist, I think, is where the real prestigious, because that's, you know, somebody actually evaluated your blog and decided that it was worthwhile. And but the voting among the finalists for the winner is really just kind of a fake popularity contest, because it's all about who could mobilize the troops.
Who's got the most cousins and second cousins they can call. And
the main problem is that for best science blog, there really are a lot of good people in there, and a lot of our buddies are on there. There's, you know, you, and there's Bad Astronomy, and there's PZ, and there's Greg Layden, and Mark from Improbable Research. So the problem is that you're all splitting the vote, and so then all the crazies just.
But
that,
that's why what we need is a lot of skeptics voting. So if you haven't voted, go to the site. We'll have the link on the the notes page for this episode. It's also in my blog. I'm sure any of these blogs will link to them. Also, Science-Based Medicine was a finalist in the New Medical Blog Awards, or the New Medical Blog category for the Medical Blog Awards. That's a separate award run by MedGadget. And we're actually – Science-Based Medicine is in the lead at the moment, at the time we're recording this. We would appreciate you taking a look. ORAC from Respectful Insolent is also nominated under different categories, and Val Jones, who also blogs on science-based medicine, was nominated for her personal medical blog, Better Health, which is also excellent. Anyway, we'll have all the links. Take a look. We'd like to have skepticism well represented among the science and medical blogs for 2008.
Yes. Nice.
We have a new Randy's Speak this week, but before we go to that, I'd just like to point out that the JREF is now producing their own YouTube channel. If you just go to YouTube.com and search for James Randi, you will find their channel, which already has their first video up, and this is an excerpt from that video.
And now, Randy Speaks.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, as the case may be. I'm James Randi. As an educator, I'm very much aware of the single most important factor that differentiates our species from all others: the ability to communicate, verbally or by writing, so that we may be in touch with past or future generations of our kind. We've learned to examine records left to us by previous inhabitants of our world, as well as to create our own records for those who will follow us. Back in the 1930s, a semanticist named Alfred Korzynski invented a term for this ability. He called it time binding, and I find that to be a very good expression for this valuable function. This is why I believe that our language skills should be carefully controlled and restrained, used with great care. Meanings are often confused and lost between individuals and cultures. What I'm really concerned about here is how careless we can be and are in our everyday conversation, and in our advertising. Take this example. This is something that popped up in my mailbox just today. It advertises that these folks are offering me natural chicken. And I really have a hard time imagining an unnatural chicken. Does it involve some moral turpitude on the part of the bird? Was the creature created in a laboratory rather than by natural and traditional means? Should this fowl be featured on an FBI bulletin? Of course, the intention of the advertiser probably was to ensure potential consumers that no growth hormones or antibiotics were used in raising the chicken. However, that term natural is so overused. It appears on packaging and in TV ads very frequently and serves as a generally comforting word to the unwary. Because as I've often said, gravel and bird droppings, as well as belladonna and strychnine, are also natural. Just this morning, I heard a weather forecast on TV warning that a warm front was approaching and could drop a ton of moisture on us. But the approximate weight of the amount of water that will be precipitated is far more information than I'd like to have or need. Oh yes, I understand that this is only an expression, but it's a careless one. I hear the same term being used by economists like a ton of problems. for example, and by would-be Martha Stewarts as, in a ton of flavor. And I'm quite certain that these items are not thus measured. Redundancies. You know what I mean. References to rich millionaires, stupid superstitions, and self-serving politicians are increasingly popular errors of speech used by newscasters. Recently, I heard references to a plummeting drop in prices. What other kind? And the current political uncertainty of today. Duh. And to a deadly fatality. This sort of usage appears to be an attempt to emphasize an expression, but it fails. And if I hear once more a reference to a definite fact or an unfortunate tragedy, I just may give up viewing TV for at least the next 20 minutes. I note that persons being interviewed on the NBC Today show almost invariably begin every single response with the word, well. The grammatical function of that I'd be hard-pressed to define, and these folks also seem to have forgotten how to pronounce the simple word, yes, using instead the word, absolutely, as if to assure the audience and the interviewer that there is just no other possible affirmative answer. Of course, the word, no, is equally neglected, being replaced by absolutely not. Fewer things than they might imagine are absolute in any respect. And have you noticed prices of merchandise and services seem to always end in nine? A monstrous piece of machinery was offered for sale just last week on television at a price of $499.99. Now, tell me, is there anyone who would choose to believe that this is not $500? Consider, that saving of 1 cent amounts to 1/50,000th of the price. Wow, such a bargain. Yes, we're familiar with paying gas prices like $1.99 a gallon, saving 1/200th of the price, and perhaps pretending that it's not $2. But is anyone fooled into celebrating the saving of 1 cent, perhaps 20 cents on a fill-up? I ask that question quite seriously because highly paid ad executives seem to think that they are. Bottom line, despite improvements in communication skills, we still have Sylvia Brown and John Edwards speaking to dead people, quacks shaking up homeopathic compounds while shaking down the suckers, and some naifs out there still believe that a certain conjurer with a four-trick repertoire can bend spoons with his thoughts. Certainly not a skill that has brought us anything in the way of a benefit, any more than breaking light bulbs would make our lives better or richer. Finally, as a careless flaw in our use of language, I'll mention a speech item that particularly irks me and is heard very often here in the USA. It's the term, you know, inserted every few words by sports figures, politicians, and so many different people in so many different circumstances. I once recorded a telephone conversation, with the permission of the caller, of course, and I later played it back to him, asking him to count the number of times he'd dropped in a, you know, as a sort of punctuation to his narrative. He listened to 4 minutes that I'd selected from the recording and announced a total of 8 times that he'd used the expression. He had actually said it 18 times, not 8, but it had become such a part of his speech pattern that he simply didn't notice it. Other offensive phrases of this kind are, I mean, and like, randomly dropped into conversations ad nauseum, far more often than we think. Well, that's today's tirade, and I hope that you feel thoroughly scolded. I think we'd do well to pay more attention to what we're really saying and what we're really trying to express so that our communication can be more useful to all of us. Like, you know, I mean...
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake.
Yeah.
The new year, guys.
That's right.
So, 09.
09.
There we go.
We do have a theme.
Ooh.
We have a theme. Uh-huh. For the first one this year. Those amazing animals. Guys, remember that cracky show from the 80s or whatever?
Animals, I think is what it was called.
No, Those Amazing Animals.
No, there was another show called Animals. Yeah,
I think it was called Those Ridiculous Animals, right?
It was also the New Zoo Review. Remember that animal?
New Zoo Review.
Oh, my God.
All right, so these are all items about animals, of course.
It's a frog.
Here we go. Item number one, Scientists discover the first vertebrate species whose eyes use a mirror to focus light on the retina. Item number two, scientists discover that the male field cricket copulates using specialized components of its mouth parts. And item number three,
sexy.
A new analysis reveals that pterosaurs launch themselves into the air from four legs, not two, as was previously assumed. Jay, you have the honor of going first in 2009.
Awesome.
I predicted you were going to pick me first. All right, guys. 09. Scientists discover the first vertebrae species whose eyes use a mirror to focus light on the retina. All right, of course, I'm going to ask you, like, what do you mean by
a mirror?
What do you mean by a mirror biologically? Like, how can you draw a comparison between?
As opposed to a lens. So a lens, you know, focuses light. The light passes through a lens to focus the light. A mirror reflects the light.
All right, so it's a biological mirror.
Yes.
Gotcha. Item number two, scientists discover that the male field cricket copulates using specialized components of its mouth parts. I would believe anything that's said about insects that's weird and disgusting. So I would have no reason to disregard that. And number three, a new analysis reveals that...
Pterosaurs.
Pterosaurs.
I'm looking at that word and I'm like, God damn, I know how to pronounce that. There's a funny backstory to this, but I won't go into it now. A new analysis reveals that Rebecca launched themselves into the air from four legs, not two.
Doesn't make sense.
As was previously assumed. I'm going to say that last one is the fake.
Okay. Evan?
The first one, in which the species whose eyes uses a mirror to focus light on the retina, I think that is fascinatingly plausible.
Okay.
I really think that one is science. The second one, male field cricket using specialized components of its mouth parts. Sure, like Jay said, so much weirdness and bizarre stuff goes on in the insect community. Nothing really surprises me there. However, the last one, four legs, not two, too Orwellian for me. So I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Orwellian? Did Orwell ever write about a pterodactyl?
Pterosaur.
Four legs, two legs, animal
pterosaur
farm.
Is a pterodactyl.
Okay.
Well, pterodactyl is a pterosaur, right? I mean, that's the same thing.
Pterosaur
is
the category. Pterodactyl is a specific species.
There you go.
Yeah. So he says, shut up, Bob. I have no idea. I haven't read anything about any of these. And I was leaning the same way as the guys. It was kind of between the male cricket doing it with his mouth and pterosaurs launching from four legs. I don't think that you would have made up the cricket thing. So I'm gonna go with the crowd and say that pterosaurs launched themselves in the air from six legs. That was the actual news item. They found that they had six legs instead of four.
Okay.
I don't know. I think you're lying about the third one.
Okay. Bob?
I'm not going with the crowd. I think pterosaurs were big and heavy. I mean, these are not birds. These are heavy, heavy reptiles, and I think four legs would give them a leg up, so to speak, getting in the air.
Ha ha ha!
Let's see. The male field cricket copulating using components of its mouth parts. I could see that. I could. I don't know if I want to see it, but I could. Nothing like that surprises me.
You'd see it and you'd pay for it.
It's all about
cricket porn.
Taking over function from body parts that had other functions. I could see the evolution doesn't surprise me in that way. So I'm buying that. Number one, I've got a problem with.
Uh-huh.
You've got a vertebrate that is using a mirror to focus light on the retina. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is whack. I can't imagine, I don't want to use an argument from incredulity, but I can't imagine how that would be. I mean, if you're a vertebrate, I would think you'd already have a good set of eyes like other vertebrates already have. I mean, how are you going to evolve your lens into just a reflective surface? And wouldn't you have a problem focusing? Because, I mean, that's one of the good things about a lens is that it focuses the light onto the retina. A mirror-like piece of tissue would just reflect it, and I think it would mess up the focus and distort it in funky ways. So I'm not buying that one at all. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Alrighty. Well, let's take them in order. The first one, scientists discovered the first vertebrate species whose eyes use a mirror to focus light on the retina. Bob just didn't buy that one. The rest of you had no problem with it. And that one is science.
Because maybe the species' eyes, you know, it's not using it to see primarily or something like
no,
that.
No, it's using it to see. So okay. This is the four-eyed spookfish.
Ooh.
But it does not have four eyes. It has two eyes. Just look kind of looks like it has four eyes.
Four legs.
And
that's confusing.
It is unusual, Bob, and it has to precisely reflect the image onto the retina without the distortion, as you say, in order for it to be useful. But it actually has, if you can imagine, like an opening below the eye that allows light up into behind the eye, and then it gets reflected by a mirror back onto the backside of the retina.
It's like a rear projection television system.
Yeah, kind of. But light can also still pass through the lens onto the retina from the other direction, so actually you could see in two different ways.
No.
Which is why I had to be careful the way I worded it. I didn't say instead of a lens, just because it actually does both. But very cool, very cool. And it's very surprising. It was the first time, again, this has been discovered in a vertebrate, although they specifically said the first vertebrate example of it. So I assume then, therefore, there are non-vertebrate examples, although I didn't have time to track those down. Mm-hmm. If anybody knows what the non-vertebrate species are that have the same kind of mirror reflection, let us know.
So what's the advantage here?
The mirror worm.
Well, it's like getting an image from below itself, I guess, if you get a mirror. So whatever shines up on the bottom of it gets then reflected back onto the retina.
Sweet.
By the
That's
mirror.
Advantageous, yeah.
Yeah, so it has like two different kind of eye situations going on.
But one retina.
Yeah, but one retina. Yeah.
So it's got two images being focused on the retina, and it's got to figure out, okay.
The brain must put it together.
Yeah, yeah. It's just all processing. Also, this fish is very deep. So it's at a level where there are fish using bioluminescence.
Mm-hmm.
So they think that that these eyes are mainly for looking
eyes.
for bioluminescent fish beneath them, I guess. Very cool. So that one is science.
That is
okay.
Freaky.
Go to number two. Scientists discover that the male field cricket copulates using specialized components of its mouth parts. You guys all thought that this one was true. And this one is
sexy.
The fiction.
Aha!
This is
fiction.
Congratulations,
Steve.
Steve.
Done, Steve.
Yeah, I did completely make this up.
Such a pervert.
I get the whole it's a weird insect, therefore, you know, I can buy this kind of stuff to the point where, just to be sure, I had to look up male cricket sexual anatomy.
Shut up, Steve. You did not do that for scientific.
So you were looking at cricket porn before this podcast?
I had to peruse, just for scientific purposes, some cricket porn.
It's called youcricket.com.
Steve, all you had to do was ask me. I have tons of it.
And, yes, they have phalluses in the usual place, you know, the other end of their body, on their abdomen. So not anywhere near their mouth.
So, Steve,
parts.
Is that where the noise comes from?
No.
No, the noise comes from
their legs.
Legs.
Leggedy legs.
Oh, because they got those hot
and that
legs.
Is, like a that is a mating noise. That is that's actually cool, too. I didn't realize this until I was reading about crickets, that the males actually dig a little hole in the ground, and that little hole serves as like an amphitheater, and it amplifies the sound.
Cool.
And then they use their hind legs to generate the sound. And that's their mating call to the female.
Parabolic action.
And evolution doesn't exist. Come on.
So, but this was inspired by a real story, and this is interesting. So, male crickets fight with each other over mating rights. They like head wrestle, so they fight with their mouth parts. And in fact, it's in Chinese culture for centuries. There's a tradition of betting on fighting male crickets. You know, it's like cricket fighting. So, since there's money on the line, a lot of people are paying attention to what physical characteristics of the crickets predict which one's going to win. And one of the bits of conventional wisdom was that the crickets with the bigger heads are better fighters and are more likely to win. A study was just published looking at that, and they found that, indeed, bigger-headed male crickets are more likely to win fights against smaller-headed, smaller-mouthpieced crickets. Mm-hmm. Male crickets with smaller heads and mouthpieces, which makes perfect sense. You know, sure. They're headbutting, the bigger head wins. Yeah. Which means that a new analysis reveals that pterosaurs launched themselves into the air from four legs, not two, as was previously assumed, is science. Mm-hmm. This is very interesting. This was a study looking specifically at, and this is, pterosaurs all have crazy names. My famous is the Quetzalcoatlus. But this one that they were studying,
named after the Aztec
particular,
god or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
After the Aztec. But this one was the Hatzegopteryx.
Oh, yeah.
And this one, when it stood on its four legs, it was as big as a giraffe. And actually,
awesome.
Similarly proportioned. Wow. I have a picture of like a an artist rendition of one next to a giraffe, and they're pretty similar in proportion. So imagine a giraffe leaping into the air and flying, and that's basically an accurate image. And what they did is they looked at the stresses on the bones, and they found that a pterosaur this size could not launch itself into the air from two legs. That it would have needed the strength of all four legs, and in fact, the four limbs are stronger, and that suggests that they used them, to do that, to launch themselves into the air. Well, it's 2009; it's a new year, and as promised, we have a new segment for the Skeptic's Guide.
Oh boy.
A brand new segment. Evan gets credit for this one. This was his idea, although it was inspired by the bird sound segment that we had last month, or it might have been in November. It was so much fun, we decided to make it a regular segment, but
it was
not limited to bird sounds. So, Evan, why don't you describe what the new segment's going to be?
The new segment is going to be a game in which we're all going to play, in which I'm going to play a noise, and you're going to have to write in and guess what the noise is. And next week we'll reveal what the actual noise is, and if anyone got it right, and who was the first one to correctly guess.
And yes. We are going to call this segment,
Who's That Noisy?
We're going to call the segment, Who's That Noisy? The background on that name is when my daughter was 2 years old and she was just learning how to speak, instead of saying, what's that noise, she would say, who's that noisy? It's just one of the cute little things that she said when she was learning how to talk. And so, like Evan and I, we have been saying it for the last 8 years or 7 years. And when we were talking about this segment, we just sort of naturally were referring to it by that phrase, who's that noisy? So it kind of stuck. So we decided just to keep it.
We're going to keep it.
We're going to keep it.
We're going to keep it. Because we like it.
Rebecca thought it was cute, so we decided to keep
it. Cute enough, at least.
Now, we're going to have some kind of formal intro to the segment, like we do for science or fiction. What we're going to do for now, go with Rebecca's idea, is to have our listeners send in recordings of them saying, who's that noisy? And feel free to be creative with it. Do whatever you want with it. And each week, we'll use a different listener-submitted intro for the segment of them saying the phrase, who's that noisy? And we may also get other people to do it as well, like people that we know, to do intros as well. But we're also opening it up to our listeners.
I'm going to play it right now.
What the hell?
Did you get that?
That's tough.
I should say that when I come up with these sounds that I'm going to be playing every week, the common theme that they will all have is that they will have something to do with science or skepticism.
It's going to be some science/skeptical/technological angle to the sound.
So keep that in mind when you make your guesses.
Right.
And good luck, everyone.
I like this segment.
Jay, I can't wait to hear what you chose for your first quote for 2009.
I have a great quote for the first quote of the year. This quote was sent in by Daniel Hawkins. Actually, he sent me in several quotes and gave me a great resource for some great quotes, but it just happens to be that all these quotes are all from Richard Feynman, who, if you don't know, was an American physicist known for the path integral formulation of quantum mechanics, among other things. Very, very cool person and someone that you should definitely try to learn more about. This was taken from an interview called The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, and here it is. You see, I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers that might be wrong. I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of certainty about different things, but I'm not absolutely sure about anything, and many things I don't know anything about, such as whether it means anything to ask, why are we here? But I don't have to have an answer. I don't feel frightened by not knowing things.
Good attitude.
Richard Feynman!
Excellent quote. I mean, I think that pretty much sums up the skeptical viewpoint, the skeptical worldview.
I love Richard Feynman.
And thank all of you for joining me for the first episode of 09.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
This is going to be a bang-up year for skepticism. I know
I think so.
Good luck for this year, guys.
We don't believe in luck.
But we have good vibes. Good vibes
good,
for this
good
year.
Vibes,
good love
good
for
luck.
This year.
We don't believe in that either.
Good mojo, good karma, good
no,
prana.
No, we don't believe in that.
What are you guys talking about? What are you talking about? We all have a 0% accuracy in science fiction.
Bob,
we can only go up from here.
Stop focusing on
true.
The truth, Bob.
Boy, Bob, talk about the glasses half empty.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.